men just, we are oppressors left to ourselves. Right. It's going to be white slavery over other whites that we conquer and exploit if we don't learn.
Slavery was a part of the human condition.
Because sin's a part of human
condition. Exactly.
The black slave trade originated in Africa.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
Just like the American Indian slave trade originated in America.
Right.
By other Indians.
Right.
All right. Well, hey, we are hanging out today. This is my friend Tim Barton. And so what I love to do is, Tim, you know, I always tell people friends share friends. Right. That's what they do. And so we're friends because another friend of ours, JP Decker, has shared friendship and with me, with you. And I'm trying to even think, where was it? We hung out one day at a Panera or something.
It was some kind of coffee sandwich shop.
Yeah.
Maybe Panera. I don't remember what it was.
Somebody had been trying to get us to meet for some time.
Yeah.
And I forget exactly who it was, but to them, thank you. And here I am now because I've known about you probably longer than you've known about me. You actually, you know, your dad, right? So Tim is part of the Barton clan, and the Barton clan are have been stirred to do a deep dive into American history, right? Because, you know, we always, well, listen, the God we both love and serve, right?
Yep.
Jesus says, you shall know the truth and the truth will set you free. And we're going to talk about a book that you guys wrote. So Tim's dad, David, started a ministry called Wall Builders.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Tell people the origin of the name Wall Builders.
So from the Bible book of Nehemiah,
yep.
Where Nehemiah, right, feels called to go rebuild the walls of Jerusalem, a city that's been torn down under ruins. Nehemiah 2:17, he says, come, let us rebuild the walls that we may no longer be a reproach to the people. And then it follows on, or Nehemiah 2:7, but it follows on a verse or two later, and it says, so they made themselves busy with the work of their hands to rebuild the wall, setting themselves to rebuild the wall.
Yeah, because when there's no wall, when you're vulnerable to every form of attack.
Correct.
Anything can come in and destroy the people.
Right.
And that's really what has happened in our country.
Big time.
Right.
And for Nehemiah, the work to rebuild the wall, there was a lot of skepticism and criticism from people on the outside,
yeah.
From people that, right, logically probably should have been his supporters.
Yeah.
And they said, this is crazy, don't do it. Nehemiah said, anybody that's willing, come live in the city with us. Let's do this together, work together. So the story of Nehemiah is really the story of a grassroots campaign,
yeah.
Where people are working together. Interestingly enough, it was the ungodly king that actually funds the expedition. So it's, right, the people of God.
The divine providence, right?
God, absolutely.
God works through things we'd never think he'd work through to accomplish what he wants to accomplish.
Exactly right. Yeah. I mean, is the story consistent throughout the Bible where you see God using unlikely people and unlikely moments, unlikely times and events, which we would argue is completely our story.
Yes.
My dad came from a town of 200 people, right? Way more cows than there were people. There wasn't even a stoplight in the town.
All right, let's give a shout out to the town.
Aledo, Texas.
Oh, okay. Well, but Aledo's no longer a little 200-cow town.
They're kind of a big deal now.
Yeah, it's a big deal.
That, you know, known for their high school football.
Yeah.
And it's, as the Metroplex has expanded.
Didn't I just see something crazy is going out there in Aledo that they just announced? I mean, like, there's a major development.
Right. So there's two ranches that separated Aledo from Fort Worth. It's on the west side of Fort Worth.
Yeah.
And they've sold that off, and they now have begun the development of 50,000 homes on this ranch.
Yeah.
They're estimating 250,000 people in this new development.
It was a
community.
Golf course.
Oh, golf.
There's
a couple of golf courses.
Yeah, I think there's a new, like, 100 million, I mean, some crazy over-the-top golf course development.
Right.
Okay, so whoever's building that, once it's done, Tim and David and I need to come play golf with
them. There you go.
We'll give you a shout-out on the course.
They can tie us to the ministry,
it's
right?
No longer a small little one-horse town. I mean, I think certainly dominating in Texas high school football, but we digress. All right. So your dad comes from this small town, right? This little kid from nowhere, Texas,
right?
Central West Texas.
Consistent how God often, right, to get the glory. Mm. God doesn't choose the most likely, right? So often he chooses the one that everybody else overlooked. Mm. And so we really, as we see what God has done over the decades through our ministry, what God has allowed and used my dad to do, it's certainly something that we work to stay humble, but it's kind of also easy to stay humble when you remember who you are and where you came from.
For sure.
And that you didn't do anything special. It's God doing something, and you just happen to be a vessel he's using as he's doing it.
Okay, so look, I mean, I want to get to a lot of this because I want to tell people where we are. We're filming at a place called AJE, or American Journey Experience.
Yes, sir.
We're surrounded by $70, $80 million worth of early American artifacts.
That's probably fair to say. Yeah.
and so I through the graciousness of friends, I mean, I've spent some time, you know, here and been around, and we would be crazy not to go grab some of these things and talk about them. But what we really want to talk about today, you know, is the wall that's broken down in America, okay, and why America today is vulnerable to so many crazy things. So one of the resources you have to get, you know, I'll just tell you, there's a book called The American Story, which I've got a copy of right here, okay, that David and Tim have written. So right there it is, man, The American Story. And pick it up. It's available at Amazon and everywhere books are sold.
That's right.
But would it be better if they went to wallbuilders.com?
It won't matter at all. Nope.
It won't matter at all.
We care more about people learning the information than where they purchase the book from.
Yeah, I would tell you to buy the book, get the Kindle version, and get the Audible version. Right, it's not WhisperSync though, right? Is it?
You know what that is? I do. I don't know that it is WhisperSync.
Yeah. Okay. But who cares? Be your own WhisperSync. And I'm telling you, this book will help you be like the people during Nehemiah's day. Right. What things I loved about what Nehemiah had everybody do when they rebuilt the wall is he had everybody kind of go to work right in front of their house.
Right.
Because if there's any part of the wall you ought to care about, it's the wall right in front of your house.
Right.
Okay. And so people were motivated. And Bible trivia, I know you know this. There were two things that every worker rebuilding the wall had in their hand.
Yes.
One was?
A trowel.
And the other was?
A sword.
That's it, baby. Right? So we're going to go to work and we're going to be ready. Because when you go to work, the enemies of God are going to come after you. Okay? But if you don't go to work, you're going to have no wall. And you and your posterity will be destroyed.
Right.
Okay. So one of the reasons that we're going to talk about this, and you know, I think our only backside is, you know, you're going to have another conversation after this with another friend on a podcast you do. So tell people what that podcast is.
Well, it's actually on his podcast. Oh, it's Jaco Bunyan's Ministry. And so that's another one where we're going to dive into a little bit of American history. But, I mean, this is
it's a very
normal conversation for us to have. We tend to be on a lot of different podcasts throughout the year. We have a daily radio program and podcast as well. It's the Wall Builder Show, and that's wherever podcasts are available.
Okay.
But these are the conversations that, to your point, so few people know the truth of American history, and they don't know they've been believing and buying into so many lies about America, because Jesus said, you know the truth, and the truth will make you free. Which actually, if you back up the verse before, I love in verse 31 of John chapter 8, when he says that if you do these sayings of mine, you are truly my disciples indeed. So it was the application of the word of God. When you do what God says, you're his disciples, and then when you're doing what he says, then you know the truth and it sets you free, but you can't be set free from truth you don't know. And so many Americans are being enslaved to lies about themselves, about gender. I mean, we can get into a lot of things about where the lies are, but they're being enslaved to things because they don't know the truth. And if we knew the truth, it would set us free. And part of the truth that is certainly under attack is the truth of the history of this nation.
See, there's no wall protecting people. So this is one of the things I'm involved in right now is this thing called the 1613 Project, which is going to have a lot of tie to this book, because there's a thing called the 1619 Project. And the 1613 Project is nothing like the 1619 Project, but you changed your book because of the 1619 Project. I started the 1613 Project because the latest attack, okay, on the village was the 1619 attack. And what I mean by that is this. You know, CRT, cultural Marxism, identity politics, Frankfurt School, all the little buzzwords that have been pretty prevalent the last 3 years, we're not as prevalent, not as talked about, right, until this 1619 Project came out, which was this idea, it was a rewriting of American history, okay, that basically said America was founded to propagate the slave trade and to continue white oppressive patriarchy.
Right.
Fair?
Yes.
Okay. And so let me just say something. Already a lot of people have no idea what the 1619 Project is. Now, if you live in the East Coast, it's hard to avoid it because a lot of it's been pushed into some of the school curriculum.
Yeah.
And it's made its way around the country. There's no question.
Yeah.
It's certainly like during the George Floyd era and all that, there was a lot of its fuel was kind of behind this thinking, this false understanding of why there's problems and conflicts in our country. Listen, you and I would both agree and would say all day long, racism is a problem.
Right.
Okay.
Well, sin's a problem. Racism is a sin. So, I mean, and this is one of the great ironies, too, is people so often in this Marxist ideology, they want to categorize certain sins only apply to certain groups.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, how foolish, but genuinely, right? I mean, if we were to say, well, we know that only the Irish can be prideful.
Yeah.
Well, that's a pretty racist statement, and it's a misassessment of what sin is and who sin impacts.
That's right.
The reality is that sin impacts everybody, and nobody is free from the stains of sin in their life, from their own decisions, from other people's decisions. The reason Jesus came is because nobody's perfect. And so when we're in a culture that says only one group is guilty of a certain sin, that's a pretty foolish assessment to begin with.
And you're guilty because you're a part of that group.
Right.
Right. And if you're not a part of that group, you're not guilty.
Right.
Okay. Which is just crazy because all men have sinned.
Right.
And all men fall short of the glory of God.
Right.
So, you know, anyway, that's no new information probably to anybody listening, except that we get sucked up into this, you know, seemingly, I don't know, I don't want to even say seemingly wise. We get caught up in a cultural narrative that finds false solutions that really are deceitful philosophies that make their way into the city and destroy the city, which is why we got to rebuild the wall of truth.
Right.
So what I did is I took 1613 Project. And I just said, like, that's not a year. I laughingly say this all the time. You know, it's called the 1619 Project. That's not when the pilgrims landed at Plymouth, but 1619.
That's when they say the first shipload of slaves arrived in the New World,
that's
which
is
not correct at all.
Yeah.
There were slaves in America way before that because Columbus, when he discovers the New World, actually discovers islands of the Caribbean. It's argued that his fourth journey, he might have landed on mainland America, but he sailed for the Spanish. And the Spanish were part of the African slave trade since kind of its origins, the beginnings in the 1500s. And the Spanish had colonies from Florida all the way up to the Carolinas in the 1500s, and they had African slaves at all their colonies. So there was black slavery in America way before Jamestown. So and I'm only saying it to give a perspective of when people say when slavery first arrived in America. No, it didn't, first of all. But then secondly, there were native tribes here way before you had Western Europeans arrive, and now historians, archaeologists, anthropologists have all agreed that the native tribes that were living here, between 20-40% of native tribe populations were other native slaves from tribes they had conquered and captured and then enslaved those people. Slavery was a part of the human condition.
Because sin's a part of human condition.
Exactly.
And so, by the way, you know, we talked about how, you know, the black slave trade didn't first arrive in the New World in 1619, which is kind of what the 1619 Project implies. The black slave trade originated in Africa.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
Just like the American Indian slave trade originated in America by other Indians.
Right.
Okay. And so we are oppressors left to ourselves.
Right.
It's going to be white slavery over other whites that we conquer and exploit if we don't learn. If our hearts aren't conquered by the kindness and the good of Christ.
Right.
Right? So, yes, that's the whole 1619 Project. So I was like, I'm not really worried about the Frankfurt School. I mean, I am because it's currently the thing coming over the wall, or there is no wall anymore, of what I would call moral, religious, virtuous education, which we're going to talk about that, okay? But I just said, we got to rebuild the wall. And so the scripture says first of all, 1613 is not a year. The only thing I think that happened in the year 1613 that I can find of any importance is apparently there was a fire in some English theater while some Shakespearean play was going on. So I don't exist to preserve theater in London, right? And specifically Shakespearean theater. That's not the 1613 Project. It's not a year. But what it does, it gets me in a conversation with people, go, what is the 1613 Project? And what I don't come right out and just say, well, it's from 1 Corinthians 16:13, which says, be in the alert, stand firm in the faith, act like men, be strong. And then I also tag 14 on there, which is so important. Let all you do be done in love. I go, hey, it's just a group of people that understand there's philosophies, there's worldviews, there's understandings that if they're not rooted in truth and reality, they're gonna hurt people and destroy society.
Mm-hmm.
And so the antidote to those bad ideas and bad philosophies is the truth. The truth is the wall, right?
Yeah.
And so it's a group of people that love to discuss philosophy, worldview, human perspectives and just different perspectives of how men should organize. And we come up with what we think is the best way for men to organize. And then we courageously seek to apply that to our culture because we care about our culture. And we realize we're going to get criticized by those who disagree with us.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to have those conversations in a loving way. Now, what I just did is walked you through 1 Corinthians 16:13 and 14. Okay. And so I work with businessmen. I work with people in the entertainment, people in the arts and media, and certainly within Christian communities, schools, and families. That's the 1613 Project, okay? And the reason I called it that is because the only reason 1619 Project gains any legs is because we don't have 1613 people.
Right.
Okay, so when the 1619 Project hit the Barton household, you guys didn't go, oh, wow, look, we should be ashamed of our white skin. We should be ashamed of America because you had truth.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And you graciously put a lot of that truth in this book. All right. And one of the things I told you earlier, one of the things I love about this, you know, I think I took AP US History, and took is the right word. I didn't excel at, but I took AP US History in 11th grade. Okay. And I would love to be, to know what I know now and mm-hmm. go back and listen. And really be a student. We all say that, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, we're just kind of making our way through, but I love history. And you know, you can have entire AP classes on just one little segment of American history. But what you guys did is you took, I think, the most important part of American history, and you made it really accessible in this book.
Thank you.
I mean, it's fantastic. So, I mean, I'm not doing this because Tim's on the podcast. I've been doing it behind his back for quite some time. And in fact, this thing we got called the Remnant News, you guys were nice enough to let us put a chapter out for free and direct people to it right there before Thanksgiving, where we talked about some of the early Thanksgiving traditions in Squanto and others and that were there. So I want to get to the wall that God had built in early America.
Yeah.
Okay? Which completely contradicts the nonsense of what the 1619 Project says. And I want to do something for sure, because we're sitting not far from Thomas Jefferson's original draft of the Declaration of Independence.
Yep.
Like, so just before we're going to talk about that, but tell them what's right behind you, like 10 feet behind you.
So yeah, we have what's called or considered the first printing of the original draft of the Declaration of Independence. So Thomas Jefferson is the guy who does the original draft. He's part of the Committee of Five. When the Continental Congress realizes they're going to separate from Great Britain, they say, we can't just say we're separating. As educated, sophisticated individuals, we need to be able to announce and explain the reasons for the breakup, right? Because this is, in essence, the greatest breakup letter ever written. And they say, we want to explain to people why we're dividing this relationship.
And
right?
why it's justifiable,
correct,
necessary,
correct,
and good.
All of those things.
Yes.
And so he's in the Committee of Five. It was John Adams, Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson. There was Livingston and Sherman are the five that are on that committee. And Jefferson's the young guy there, but he's already done some writing in Virginia, and he's kind of recognized and say, okay, you're the one in charge. So he's been the Continental Congress for over a year. He takes all the things he's heard, he synthesizes it, and he puts together this document. The original draft, when it comes back, there's 24 grievances in the original draft. Now, in the final draft, there's 27. John Hancock at the time was a president of Congress. He said they would only include in the final version what was unanimous to the body, because John Hancock pointed out that if there's disagreements between Georgia and New York, right, between Pennsylvania and Virginia, he said the king might be able to come in and pull us apart by our own local separate interests. So we have to be unanimous in our agreements. And this is where also you can reference back to Benjamin Franklin giving the famous statement that surely we must all hang together or else we will all hang separately, right? I mean, adding a little humor to this thought, but that's where they came. So when the original draft comes back, they keep the majority of the original draft. But what's worth noting, the original draft is 4 pages. On the third page, the last grievance is by far the largest grievance. It's nearly half of the page. And it was a grievance against the slave trade and arguing for the humanity of the individuals being enslaved that were coming out of Africa. And as it goes before the Continental Congress, they're debating line by line, issue by issue, grievance by grievance. And they come to this last grievance. And Jefferson wrote that it was very saddening to him that there weren't more ardent anti-slavery voices from the North that were able to compel more from the South, because there were two colonies that said they didn't think that grievance needed
Georgia,
to be there.
Georgia, South Carolina?
Georgia and South Carolina.
Yeah.
They said, specifically, this was a grievance against the slave trade and arguing for the humanity of the slaves, but they said, we haven't tried to end the slave trade in our colony, and so we don't think, like, this isn't a grievance. We don't have this problem with the king. Let's only include what all of us have problems with.
In other words, at the time, there were English colonialists, right? They had settled here as colonies of England.
Right.
And it was permissible within England to practice slavery.
England was a major player in the international slave trade, the North Atlantic slave trade, and they had slavery in all of their colonies.
Right. And so they didn't. And so Georgia, South Carolina were saying, hey, we don't have a problem with that.
Right.
Right.
It's kind of who we are and what we do. Right. Now, what's also interesting is that 11 of the colonies voted in favor of that grievance, saying, yeah, we support this, But the reason was because the vast majority of American colonies had begun passing laws several years earlier against the slave trade and even against slavery itself. And the king had vetoed all of those laws, which led some of the founding fathers, who were some outspoken abolitionists, to say, this is one more reason we should separate from the king, because he won't even let us end slavery in our own colonies. Mm. This was a motivating factor for many founding fathers who were involved that most people have no idea. And again, the reason this matters is in this document, the original draft of the Declaration, Jefferson talked about the fact that the king was saying he's a Christian, but he's doing what the Muslims, by the way, from North Africa, there were five Muslim nations in North Africa. They're the ones who started the exportation of Africans in the slave trade, because there was already an intercontinental slave trade, as you kind of alluded to earlier, mm-hmm. where Africans were enslaving other Africans. But that was the way every people did. Asians enslaved Asians, Europeans enslaved Europeans.
Right.
That was very normal.
Romans enslaved Romans. Right. And so it's always been, oppression has always been a part of sinful humanity.
Correct.
And
always.
What you're saying is it was the northern five nations in Africa that were largely Islamic in their
Correct.
Formation, who said, you know what? We can prosper if we export this
Correct.
Idea.
We can make a market. We can make a lot of money yeah. on this. And once there was money to be made, then you had the Dutch and the Spanish, right? The Portuguese,
People
all these,
show up.
Right? The English. If you can make money, we want to make money on this. And especially if you don't have the moral foundation from the Bible that tells you that you should not financially benefit off someone else's hardship or, right, whatever the enslavement kind of vocabulary we might add to that, right? You should not try to elevate yourself by suppressing someone else, but this is what was happening. And the reason, again, this kind of matters is because Jefferson, in the original draft of the grievance, he said the king is doing what these Muslim nations are doing. The king is pretending like he's a Christian, but he's clearly not acting like a Christian, and he's enslaving these men. And Jefferson capitalizes the word men, capital M-E-N, and he prints it. The original draft is all in cursive, except for a few words. The title, United States of America, is printed and capitalized. The only other word printed and capitalized is when he says that the king's enslaving these men. He capitalized and he prints it, and he even underlies it, drawing attention to the fact that these are human beings
yes.
that this is happening to. And the reason it matters is because in the second paragraph, he writes, "Will these truths be self-evident that all men are created equal?" Some people today argue, well, he's only talking about white people. No, he wasn't. Go back and read the original draft. He literally spelled it out. It was all humanity.
And one of the things that's so important. I mean, what you just heard is real American history. So I'll be honest with you. I didn't know this until recently. It might have been when I went through here, because it's always bothered me. I always have said, you know, when Jefferson wrote and the 70 some odd signers of the Declaration, how many were there?
56.
56. So those other 14, I don't know where they came from. But the 56 signers of the Declaration, how they could sit there and say with a straight face that all men are created equal and are not by the Creator with certain inalienable rights. And then they would have this entire class of people that they treated so inhumanely.
Right.
Okay, that has always troubled me. It should trouble anybody with any kind of clarity of thought.
It seems openly hypocritical.
And it is. But what we don't know is that the guy who wrote that first sentence wrote that other grievance that was later pulled.
Right. And it's also worth noting that once we separate from Great Britain, every single northern colony begins now passing the laws that had been previously vetoed by the king. They all begin passing laws against the slave trade and against slavery. And by 1804... every single northern colony has passed laws, not just against the slave trade, but for the abolition of slavery, making the New England colonies in America the first major region anywhere in the world to effectively abolish slavery. And England didn't abolish slavery until 1833.
Right.
So you're also talking about a political movement that was started in America before anybody else, started by founding fathers in America, and we beat England by 30 years in ending slavery in our region.
You could make a case that not only is the 1619 Project wrong, it is almost antithetical to the purpose of why some of the separatists came here.
Correct.
Okay? And it's like not only did we not come to continue the oppression of the Africans, okay, or to abolish the Indians, we came, like the original folks that came to America, I think what is it Acts 16? I think it's Acts 16 where Paul has a vision of the Macedonian man that says, come.
Yes.
And I think one of the reasons, one of the ways they encouraged other believers to come with them is they put a picture of an American Indian.
Correct.
Who gave them a vision like, come and bring to me the gospel that saves all humanity.
It was a call for missionaries. And it's literally in the Mayflower Compact, the propagation of the gospel that we whose names are undersigned for the glory of God and the advancement of the Christian faith. That's part of the Mayflower Compact. It literally, the vast majority of groups that came over. Now, you might could argue Jamestown maybe is a little different because they were an England colony. And they acknowledged God in the Bible. They didn't really follow the Bible teachings very well, but that's Jamestown. If you look at the northern colonies, whether we talk about Plymouth, and really you talk about Massachusetts because you had the Massachusetts Bay, you had the Plymouth colonies, but you could talk about Connecticut and Rhode Island. You could talk about Pennsylvania, which is also so many great ironies with the modern narrative today.
I know.
Pennsylvania founded by William Penn, the Quakers. The Quakers were always against two things, war and slavery.
Mm-hmm.
And we're pretending today, right, like all of America was so oppressive. No, it wasn't. William Penn, when he gets Pennsylvania, his father had been an admiral sailing under the king and had won many military victories, naval victories. And so the king had promised him a commission for every victory. And the king was like, I don't have the money to give you, but I have this new world. And I'm going to give you land in the new world. I'm going to name it in your honor. We're going to call a section of land Pennsylvania after the Admiral William Penn. Well, the son William Penn is going to university, and he hears this new teaching from this Quaker and gets so convicted that I think this is really what God would have me do. At the time in England, which started under King Henry VIII, but King Henry VIII changed the religious structure of England to be Anglican only, that it was a state-established religion. If you're not Anglican, and this wasn't just unique in England, because in Germany, you had to be Lutheran, right? And in Spain, you'd be Catholic. In Scotland, you'd be Presbyterian. Like, this is the way it happened in many nations. The king would choose a denomination, and you had to follow that denominational belief, or you could be thrown in prison. And in fact, you could even be executed in some places if you didn't follow the doctrinal beliefs upheld by the state-established church. So William Penn is a Quaker.
And by the way, I just want to... You know, it's so interesting because we could talk right here, insert conversation about quote-unquote Christian nationalism. The reason that leaders sometimes, well, not sometimes, they want to coalesce people among a common worldview is they realize if we are divided, we will be destroyed.
Correct.
And it goes back to the famous quote by Jefferson, right? We either hang together or we'll hang apart, right? Right,
Franklin, but yes.
I said Jefferson, but Franklin, yes. We either hang together or hang separately. Is that what he said?
Yes, yeah.
And I think, you know, and so when I think kings know that, and so they advocate for a certain worldview.
Right.
So people always organize around a worldview.
Right.
Okay, and Jesus is the one that says this. I always, you know, tongue-in-cheek when I talk about how I think in Gettysburg, where Lincoln talks about a house divided cannot stand,
mm-hmm.
right? And I thought how brilliant of Jesus to quote Lincoln the way that he did, you know, in Matthew 12, okay? Because obviously that's a quote from Scripture.
Right.
And so there has to be a unifying understanding of reality. Otherwise, it's going to turn into civil war and craziness, which is why, again, you know, in a democracy, okay, where you've got to have civil discourse and you've got to have people have an opportunity to have freedom of speech.
Yeah.
Okay. If people aren't equipped and ready to respond to new philosophies and an enlightened understanding that we can be dismissive towards the revelation of a kind and benevolent and a good God, right? If we're going to take you know, some prophet from Mecca or Medina, or we're going to take some prophet from upstate New York, or we're going to take just the ideas of the French Enlightenment and rationalism, okay? That's going to work its way into society and have its effect.
Right.
So you and I would say, hey, we're not afraid of civil discourse, right? You bring your best ideas, but I will tell you there is a wall of truth that you will not penetrate.
Right.
Because the Christian idea works.
Right.
And it's the only one that really will work if it is employed.
Yeah, and this is one of the great ironies when people talk about that you can't you can't legislate morality, right? And I'm using this in a reference to like even the Christian idea, the Christian value system. Why do we promote Christianity above everything else? It's not just because I believe in Jesus, although that is obviously the most important, only thing that matters, that's enough. But the reality is if we want to be free in society, the founding fathers acknowledged that America, the Constitution, it only works if you have a religious and a moral people. And the reason was, which, by the way, Washington said that in his farewell address. John Adams wrote that in a letter in 1778 when he was president, saying that our Constitution was made only for a moral religious people, totally inadequate to the government of any other, is because if you don't have a moral people, freedom will never work. And the founding fathers believed in freedom for the people. They wanted to get out from under the tyranny, the oppression of a king, of a tyrant, a dictator. But they knew that if you give freedom to immoral people, all that happens is immoral things. And so you have to have a moral code. But this is why Christianity becomes important, because some people would argue, well, we don't have to be Christian to be free. And I would raise the question, right? Then we're going to have a moral code to follow. So whose moral code would you suggest we follow?
That's right.
Because at this point, the real conversation is who offered the best moral code for us to live in freedom so that we can have a right, some kind of right and wrong, yes and no system to follow. How do we know? How do we determine right and wrong? There has to be a moral code. So whose moral code do we follow? And I would challenge anybody. I've never found anybody who's a better moral teacher than Jesus, right? Nobody anywhere. And this is where even sometimes I'll speak on universities and I'll have this conversation with college kids as I promote that freedom is America was built on the notion of we the people being in charge of freedom, being able to be a pursuing kind of our own courses because we have private property. You know, the king, there was no private property, and the king would grant land to nobles and whatever, right, kind of executives he liked. And then there was peasants and serfs, but nobody had their own things. So in freedom, you can pursue so much of your own dream, your destiny. If God's given you gifts and talents and abilities, and you can be an entrepreneur, that this what used to be known as the American dream, right? This was kind of the idea. But all of that only works if we can collectively agree on some code for ethics and morals to go by. And to be intellectually honest, I'll even tell college kids, right? I suggest Christianity because I think it's the best moral system for us to enjoy the most freedom. But if you can show me a better moral system,
let's go.
Right? If freedom is the goal, then I am totally open to a better moral system. And this is where it's really fun having a discussion with college kids because most of them have never done this intellectual thought exercise.
That's right.
Because, okay, well, let's talk about the morals of Islam. Let's talk about the morals of Hinduism or Buddhism. Let's talk about those morals and what does that produce? What value system is there? So this is where also when people talk about, well, you're being a Christian nationalist. No, I'm pro-freedom,
yeah.
Right? Now, ultimately, I'm very pro-Jesus and yeah. I want everybody to know Jesus and find the freedom and the hope and the healing, right? To become a new creation. Old things pass away. All things are new. There's so much I want for people in their life. To know God like I've come to know God and know Jesus. I want that for people. But when I'm putting on the hat, right, of culture and politics, well, I want people to be free. So I'm promoting what helps people be the most free. Well, you're just promoting Christian values. No, there has to be a moral code and system. No nation can exist without morals.
Right.
So then it's only a question of whose morals are the best. And this is where the founding fathers universally agreed. No disagreement.
Yeah, even amongst us, because the so-called, well, some of them were deists, some of them were atheists. You know, Thomas Paine famously did
right.
not hold to Christianity. And I think
no.
Ben Franklin was the one that said to him, hey, you may not hold to Christianity as a individual who professes Christ and seeks to live according, but you, Thomas, right, who wrote Common Sense,
yeah.
you're living by common grace.
Right.
And that's what makes you a good citizen and yep. why I want you to be my neighbor, because this Christianity you reject informs everything you do. So,
yes.
you'll be a fine neighbor because
right.
you know you can't kill, you can't sleep with my wife, you can't steal.
Right.
Right.
Franklin says, who knows, but that it was the very system you are criticizing that taught you all the morals that you now boldly proclaim that you have great morals. Franklin says, where do you think you learned those?
That's right.
It was the system you are now criticizing.
The country that you grew up in. With I don't know where Payne grew up.
Well, initially it was over in England. He comes to America, but still, it's Western civilization.
There you go.
So you're growing up. Western civilization becomes defined by the Ten Commandments.
Yeah.
Because that was the foundation of law for all of Western world, Western civilization. And certainly you had leaders that followed those standards better than others. But everybody grows up with a basic understanding, which actually the kings would point to the Bible as their ultimate reason for their position of authority.
Yep.
And so even though they would abuse that position and disregard much of what the Bible taught, they still reference the Bible as their place of authority. So even growing up in England, you're very familiar with the Ten Commandments. You're very familiar with the Bible. But as you become a student of so much of the growth of Western civilization education, so much of it came from Christian thinkers, philosophers that Payne has studied and then comes to America and he loves America. America's amazing. It's great. And Franklin's like, why do you think it's great? Right? The very system that you are criticizing, saying you think Christianity is dumb and all these miracles couldn't have really happened because it doesn't line up with reason and your logic. You don't think that's possible.
Right.
The system you're criticizing is what has laid the foundation that you love and enjoy.
That's it. So this idea, even of American exceptionalism, is really, it is the embracing of common grace.
Yeah.
It's the embracing of what will make humans flourish and will create an exceptional civilization. Now listen, you and I both believe, or, you know, we're both Christ followers. We both understand that God wants us to do more than just have a successful, expanding Aledo.
Right.
He doesn't want us just to have a happy 80 years. He's trying to say, because even in the best small town America, sin still exists.
Correct.
And judgment is still due. And so unless we deal, no matter how small town America, Midwestern, Western Civ, Ten Commandish-ish, our society is, it still falls short of what God intended.
Big time.
Right? And so we have to figure out how we are going to make peace with our soon and coming king who doesn't like any compromise among his people.
Right.
And so praise God, we have a king that's not looking just to come and destroy us. He's coming to rescue us and make provision for our shortcoming so that we would learn his ways and love him even more and repent even more of the imperfection in our Aledo. Which is one of the things that we touched on this, and man, we're covering so much. And before I forget it, because I will, because the conversations are so gripping to me, right? This is the chapter I spent a little bit of time when you were talking looking for. This is one of my favorite chapters in the book, right? So it's called Choosing the Right Moral System. And it's what you and I just talked about, where you said universally, literally, we don't believe that every founding father was what we would call ourselves today.
Right.
Right? A by grace, through faith, abiding, humble Christians.
Right.
Followers of Jesus. No question, not every American founding father thought that.
Sure.
But they did universally embrace virtue. It's the most often used word, right?
Right.
I mean, I learned that from you guys, right? Virtue. Right. And do you know the Benjamin Rush quote that where he just says that you can't have virtue without religion and you can't have liberty without virtue?
The only means of a useful education in a republic is to be laid in religion, because without religion, there is no virtue. Without virtue, there is no liberty. And liberty is the object in life of all republican governments.
Bro, you should write a book on American history.
I'll work on it. Yeah, do you mean, am I a Christian and do I think the Christian system is the best system for people to live by? Yes.
Yes.
Because that's what they argue as a Christian nationalist. Well, by that definition, every Christian should be a Christian.
So you and I,
if that's a definition.
That's right.